If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov. I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Isabel Legeron from Raw Wine and Justin Cherno from the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We're going to discuss natural wines and the raw wine movement. We're also going to taste an organic wine a little later in the show for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. The natural wine movement is all about nurturing biodiversity while embracing and observing nature, rather than fighting control of it. Some of the most exciting wines today are naturally made by a group of committed artisan winemakers from all over the world. Our guests Isabel Legeron and Justin Cherno will explain how natural wines differ from, well, regular wines. Our first guest is Isabel Legeron. Isabel created Raw Wine. We recorded Isabel from London yesterday. Welcome to the show, Isabel.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me around.
Great to have you. I'm excited about this show because it's pretty much the Raw Wine Natural Show, and I don't think there's anyone better than you to help us sort of navigate through all this. I want to talk to you about raw wine. I want to talk to you about the fair coming to Brooklyn and a bunch of other things. But before we get to that, I want you to tell our listeners a little about you and how you got to the point, you know, where you are now, which is Raw Wine.
So, I was brought up in France on, you know, on a farm, so growing grapes. So my background is completely, you know, into the wine production. And then fast forward a few years, you know, I wanted to understand more about wine. I went, you know, went to do some study with the WSET, the Institute of Masters of Wine, and so on. But quite quickly, I realized that, you know, what I was looking for in the wine industry was, you know, they were farmers, people connected to the land, people making wines, you know, as naturally as possible. And I realized actually the wine industry is full of not that. I realized that there was a world of wine that really resonated with my values, with, you know, the sort of activities I love doing. I love foraging, I love farming, and I realized that, you know, there was a small parallel universe full of people in a way just like me, you know, and you know, people who are farmers, but they also make the wine. They also have, you know, they also have animals. They also look at the, you know, very sort of holistic approach to farming and make wines naturally. And then that's how I ended up, I guess, drawn to this world. And they were also the wines that I loved drinking.
So you know, the wine business has been around for hundreds of years, hundreds and hundreds. All this has been going on all along, true? I mean, you grew up on a farm. I mean, were you involved in you know, the process of planting and picking and all of that stuff?
Yeah. My family were grape growers, and we've been grape growers for generations. I mean, everybody around me basically farms in the Cognac region, so
right.
We farm grapes that go into the pot still, that becomes cognac.
And they
basically
did follow sort of a natural holistic approach then and now?
When I was growing up, when I was little, yes, they did. My parents didn't really have any you know, harvesters. They did everything by hand. They cultivated by hand. They didn't use any weed killers or pesticides or insecticides or fungicides and so on. But you know, as my, I guess as my parents got into, you know, the 1970s and the 1980s, they, alongside most of our neighbors, you know, started to buy, you know, a machine to harvest.
Right.
They started to sort of spray. And then they actually converted an organic farm into a conventional farm. And it's still conventionally farmed today, actually,
right,
by my brother. So it's a very sore point in my family. We never,
right,
ever talk about the family farm.
Why did they use natural approaches towards farming? Was that because that's all they knew? Was it because it was cheaper? Was it a sense then that, you know, that was the natural way? I mean, you know, they were as much part of any natural movement then. What inspired them to do that?
It was... So when my parents took over from their respective families, my grandparents farmed completely organically. I mean, there was no other way, to be honest. And cost came into it. You know, you didn't really have any money to buy fertilizers or anything.
Right.
So it was just the normal way was to have animals and to have biodiversity. So you had grapes, you had grains, you farmed everything. They had cows, they had pigs. And that's what my parents did that initially. But, you know, my parents are part of a generation of farmers that really got led into what they called modernism. You know, they wanted to have a bit more time off. They wanted to have a little bit of holiday. And they thought that actually by spraying the vines,
right,
by using more machinery, they would get that. You know, they kind of got into... And it's that generation that changed so much,
right,
the face of farming.
It totally makes sense. I mean, because it's such a labor of love, but there's a lot of labor to that love. And I guess at some point you really want to, you know, pull back a little. All right, so let's move forward. So
yes,
did you say you got a degree in wine?
I studied at the Institutes of Masters of Wine, which is you know, which is where I got my qualification of
right,
MW, yeah, in London.
Okay, so what did you do with that? Tell me.
So that's interesting. I'm not sure what I did with it, to be honest. I mean, I worked really hard for it. And then the minute I passed, I actually just, you know, focused on developing raw wine, on actually putting all my time and energy into the wines that I loved, which is not, I would say, super commercial. So in a way, you know, I think I used my MW title to perhaps give more credibility to an,
right,
industry which is not very recognized, you know, the kind of that which is not, I would say, super commercial. So in a way, you know, I think I used my MW title to perhaps give more credibility to an,
right,
industry which is not very recognized, you know, the kind of that natural wine niche,
right,
or low intervention wines. So I think that kind of helped. And people maybe took me a little bit more seriously when I said, oh, this one is really good, even though some people might think there was something wrong with it because it was slightly cloudy, particularly at the beginning. So I think that probably was the main, I guess, the main advantage of
right,
being an MW.
Credibility.
For what I'm doing. Yeah, exactly, credibility.
What was
and
the...
it gave me a hell of a lot of theory and training and knowledge,
right,
you know, which I'm applying, obviously,
right,
every day.
But what was, you know, you said you started working on the raw wine thing. What was that defining moment when you were really focused on the fact that, hey, there's raw wine, there's a movement here, there are a lot of people committed to this, you know, I really want to move forward. What defined, you know, you moving forward on all of this?
It was about 2010, 2011, where I was, you know, I was attending all the fairs in France, you know, L'Adi Bouteille and all these really great events and, Vin Natur in Italy. And I realized, actually, we don't really have anything like this in the UK. So, you know, I decided that we needed to have a similar event. And so I created this event, but I wasn't sure how to call it, you know, because it's not just about natural wine, you know, it's about a family of vignerons that make wines,
right,
a certain way. And so we came up with the term raw wine because no one really applied raw to wine before, so it was a bit of a unique creation and almost like our way of calling it. You know, it's not a category. It's kind of becoming a bit of a category, but it's really not. You know, it's a trademark.
Right.
And it really, for us, for me, it was just, this is exactly what we're doing, where we're having these wines that are unchanged, they're pure, they haven't been tampered with,
you're defining what would be a raw wine. So I go back again. I mean, the people that are making raw wines, I guess now is a good time to ask the question, does organic, biodynamic, sustainable, natural, how do all those terms fit into the raw wine movement?
So for us, right, and to be part of the fair, because at the moment we are essentially, an event basically happening around the world.
Right.
But in order to attend this event as a grower, you have to be organic.
Okay.
You have to ferment your wine spontaneously, so there's no additions of anything.
Right.
You have to add, small amounts of sulfites, up to 70 ppm. Total for any types of wine. So,
but just
to give you an idea, so 70 parts per million is the way that you would express total sulfites, or 70 milligrams per liter. And to give you an idea, when you make white wine in Europe, for example, you can have up to 200 parts per million. If you make sweet wine, you can have up to 400 parts per million.
So it's literally a fraction of it.
So tiny amounts, and then no harsh manipulation like cell filtration, micro-oxygenation, and so on. But more importantly, you also have to be prepared to be transparent. So you have to submit analysis of all your wines. You have to mention on the website and on the catalog exactly what is done, how much sulfites, if any. I mean, many people don't add anything. And so it's this commitment to transparency, this commitment to being, to farming, organically, to fermenting your wines naturally, that actually, unites all the growers that come to the fair.
So the consumer, when they buy a bottle of wine, for someone that participates in raw wine, there's a total transparent path of growth to the winemaking, to everything. Because that's
absolutely
all documented. Don't you have a charter of quality?
Yes, we do.
You were referring to that.
On the website or on the catalog, we mentioned the charter of quality, and that is that the entirety of the vineyards where the grapes come from have to be farmed organically, biodynamically. Everything has to be manually harvested, spontaneous fermentation, no blocked malolactic fermentation, no sterile filtration, and levels of sulfites that are, under the 70 ppm total added.
So for the raw wine fair, you have how many wineries participating?
So at any given time, it really depends on where we're going. But
well,
for example,
we're coming to New York. The Raw Wine Fair is going to be taking place in Brooklyn on November 5th and 6th. Correct, Isabel? Yes.
On November 6th
and 6th and 7th. I'm sorry.
Yes, the day before the election.
Right.
6th and 7th.
Make a note, November 6th and 7th. I'm pretty sure the hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
That's right, yes.
And it's being staged at 99 Scott Avenue, which is in Brooklyn. So that's the fair. So you've staged these in Berlin, London. You're coming to New York. Did I miss any place?
No, that's it. We did one edition in Vienna, but now we're focusing on London, Berlin, and hopefully New York.
Okay, so somebody is thinking about attending the Raw Wine Fair in Brooklyn. They're coming into this knowing that they're going to be exposed to some of the best natural winemakers from all over the world, right?
Yes, the people come from all over the world. And we have natural wine producers, i.e. people who do not add anything during the winemaking process at all, including any sulfites. And we also have people that I call the more low intervention, organic and biodynamic, which means that they add very low levels of sulfites. Right. I think it's important to make the distinction because at the moment everybody bandies around the term natural. Even vineyards that are not growing grapes organically call some of their wines natural.
It's a that term is a sore spot with a lot of things, with the food movement. You know, people slap on natural pretty easily to a lot of things, and it's just not what it appears to be. So there'll be how many people, how many different wine people at the fair?
So there'll be about 130 different vignerons, you know, wine producers. There'll be over 500 wines to taste from under one single roof. We also have vermouth producer, you know, and Cuz Vermouth, in fact, which is also local to you. We have some cider producers, a mead producer, who is also from Brooklyn. So, you know, the idea for the fair is for it to be a community-led event. You know, this is very much, for me, is very much a U.S. led event. You know, we have a very large proportion of growers coming from the states, from California, Oregon, from New York State, and for me that is really important. It's not just like some people from London coming in and putting on this right. event. It's really about involving everybody. And Roberta's is actually firing up some ovens and cooking some pizzas in the courtyard.
Yes, a nice compliment to any delicious natural wine, right? The a lot of the natural winemakers initially were in France and Italy. I mean, the movement really, or the majority of winemakers that were following a natural path were from France and Italy. Is that fair to say? Because you alluded earlier that you had gone to fairs in France and you wanted to bring them to London. So I guess that means that they were doing it all along and the rest of the world wasn't really exposed to all these wines. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I mean, you know, if you, you know, like you mentioned at the beginning of this program, natural wine or making wines naturally, you know, has been around forever. You know, we've been making wine for 8,000 years or thereabouts. And when people made wine 8,000 years ago, they didn't have aromatic yeast and mega purple to add to the mix. So people have been making wines naturally forever. It's I guess what we're seeing now is a bit of a backlash against the high manipulation and the high intervention that people are doing in their wineries, and we are rediscovering these wines. We're in a way we're calling them something. We're labeling them natural wine or low intervention, and the hotbeds in a way have always been sort of, you know, France and Italy and parts of the old world, because these are very long-standing traditions. Right. You know, like Georgia is another example, where people have been farming for hundreds of years and making wines for a very long time. So it makes sense that, to be honest, that the larger proportion of natural wine producers are coming from this region.
Right. But it is catchy. Like you said, it's a lot of people are following the practices in California and Washington. It's nice that you're here in the U.S. and that there are a lot of participants, you know, following the natural way of making wine and all of that.
I know. And that's really exciting. And, you know, I'm so proud of the event coming to the States, and so happy that so many American producers have followed us and are so excited that we can all be part of this this event together. Well, because I think it is a really strong community that we're building.
I think,
you know, with the restaurants, the bars, the shops.
I was just going to say that. I think the community is incredibly committed, and I think it's the community that is educating and enlightening the consumer. I think some of the best bars, you know, in New York and even outside of New York, and some of the best wine stores have made such a commitment to natural wines, and they're such evangelists for them. You know, the lists are heavily stocked. They're pouring them. They're featuring them. They're talking about them. They're using social media very heavily to show bottles and the winemakers and the type of wines. I think the movement right now is as hot now as ever. Do you feel that?
Yes, for sure. I mean, there's such energy. You know, when I was, I visited, I came a couple of weeks ago. to New York, and, you know, saw a lot of friends and visited a lot of places, and the energy, the passion, the love people are showing, and to see those wines being poured more and more is tremendous.
Right.
You know, there is room for more. You know, don't get complacent.
No, I'm not implying
Manhattan
that.
And because there's room for more.
later in the show, we're having Justin Cherno on from the Four Horsemen in Brooklyn.
Wonderful.
And, you know, he's one of the big evangelists and proponents. You know, he had worked in retail and that. And then when they opened the Four Horsemen, you know, they made a commitment to a lot of natural wines. And, you know, he's not in the minority and all of that. All right, so...
Mm.
So
and there's a lot of really exciting places, I have to say, with, you know, with very strong... you know, natural wine lists, and Four Horsemen is one of them, Ten Bells, Rouge Tomate. I mean, the list goes on, and it's really exciting.
Brooklyn, yeah, it's great. You wrote a book about all of this. You wrote a book, Natural Wine. I think you wrote it fairly recently, you know, in the last year or so. Tell us a little about the book.
Yeah, so the book was, I wanted to sort of put everything down that I, you know, that I was thinking about natural wine. What is natural wine? I also wanted to really, I guess, showcase all the men and women who make natural wine. You know, who are they? Talk a little bit about the history, about the movement, where it's coming from. And so, you know, we published this book that is actually quite heavy on photography, but also full of stories from growers who maybe use, like, wild plants to farm their vines, people who, you know, somebody makes bread and shares with us their sourdough recipe. So, you know, it was all about sort of, it's more than just
it's about the wine, I guess.
It's more about the
community.
Lifestyle of these
right.
people.
Right. Mm. I know you're biased, but, you know, it probably is one of the better books about the subject. You know, it's fairly comprehensive. I'm not sure that there's a lot of books, you know, out there about natural wine. And it also sounds like the type of book that every few years, you know, you could do another updated edition and, you know, update any information and growers and all of that.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you so much for saying this.
You know, the book's called Natural Wine, right?
Sorry?
The book is called Natural Wine.
Yeah, it's called Natural Wine. And actually, my publisher wants to do a sort of an updated version, which will come out at the end of next year.
Perfect.
So we're out of, you know, we reprinted a couple of times, which is amazing, you know, when you write something about such a niche topic.
Right.
And we're going into an updated version, which is nice.
Well, it's funny you say niche. It is niche because... I think wine is a very big, passionate topic. People are passionate about it. You know, it's global. People really, you know, get into it. But I think the natural wine movement, like we said earlier, is really, you know, on the up and up. I think more people that don't know about it, when they find out about it, are very interested and feel good about it. You know, let's try that. Where can I get it? And I think it's becoming a little more readily available. I mean, I think you have to warn people that when they go into their typical large wine store, the selection is limited. But then there are stores like Chamber Street Wines and, you know, other places that are very committed to natural wines. And you can find all of that. All right. So let's talk about the fair again. Let's promote that. So it's the Raw Wine Fair. It is a fair with over 100 producers that Isabel and I talked about that are committed to making wines with the least amount of intervention in the most natural way. The fair is going to be in Brooklyn this coming November 6th and 7th. That's a Sunday and a Monday, right, Isabel?
That's it, yes.
Yes, and you can come between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., and it is at 99 Scott Avenue in Brooklyn. What is the space, Isabel? What is it, 99 Scott Avenue?
Well, it's a brand new space, actually. We're the first ones using it. It's beautiful. It's an old warehouse that's been that is, you know, it's almost finalized. We're sort of, you know, keeping
right.
our fingers crossed it's going to be finished.
You'll be fine.
And it's beautiful light, huge windows, a great courtyard. It was an old warehouse that is being turned into a beautiful event space.
And it'll be a walk-around format, right? Different producers at different tables?
Exactly. So the producers will be, at their tables. Everybody's going to be there to show their wines. We also have a small collection of other drinks, like I mentioned,
Vermouth.
Mead and cider and vermouth and so on. There'll be some food on site. Mm-hmm. We've got the great guys from INSA at Brooklyn are going to be doing some Korean food.
Great.
Roberta's is going to be doing pizzas. Parlor Coffee is going to be doing some coffee. So, the aim is for people to come and spend the entire day and hang around. There's also a talk program. We have four talks a day that are free to attend.
Seminars or talks? Talks, I guess.
Yeah, they're seminars, right. And they're talks.
So
yeah,
I guess
we've got some really great lineup of talks. And everything can be found on the website, which is newyork.rawwine.com.
newyork.rawwine.com.
Yes.
That's where you can get all the information. So people that intend to come should intend to spend a day. Go into a few talks. There's going to be a lot of wine to taste, so that's going to take some time. If you feel you need to clean your palate, there'll be some food there and some other things. So it's really going to be a day of incredible exposure to some very passionate wine people. Now, also, there are wine people there that are looking for distribution too, right?
Yes, that's right. The growers is a mix of people who are already distributed and represented, in New York City, but in New York State, but also actually in other places. And there is probably about, a quarter of growers who are coming to meet importers and traders and hopefully find representation.
Right. So anyone who is listening, if you have a distribution business, you're starting one, there are going to be people and wineries that are looking for some kind of representation. So it could be well worth your while to take a stroll around and meet some people and taste some wine. All right, did we miss anything on the fair?
No, that's amazing. Thank you.
All right, we could talk all day about this. I mean, it's a very exciting, the fair is very exciting. The natural wine movement and how raw wine has approached it's very exciting. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think I'm going to probably have to have you back on for progress and updates and, telling us about what has been going on. And you are welcome anytime. Did we miss anything? We got the website. We got the date.
Yeah, the only thing that's missing is, are you coming to the fair?
Am I coming?
Yes.
I'm coming I'll be there at 9:58 and I'm leaving at 6:04, okay? Yes,
okay,
I'm very much coming.
I'll be looking out for you.
I'll tell you why I'm coming, and I think it reflects a lot of the way our listeners think. Our show is geared towards the consumer. It's geared towards people that are just starting to get into wine and, don't want to be overwhelmed by it. We take an unpretentious approach toward it. We don't want to get too nerdy or too snobby. And what interested me about, you coming on the show is, I think, like I said earlier, the natural wine movement is so hot and so important. And when you get to know the people and the product, the commitment is amazing. The opportunity to go to a fair and literally rub shoulders, with the winemakers and taste the wines with a presentation, unlike anywhere else, is just a very exciting thing. And for me, separate of the radio show, as a consumer, there are just so many wines that I want to taste. There are so many people I want to talk to. And it may be a little overwhelming. I'm probably going to have to do something I don't like to do, which is spit. So whatever. So I'm looking very much forward to that. And Isabel, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about raw wine, talking to us about the fair. We will see you there. And like I said before, I would love to have you back. And I thank you for coming on The Grape Nation.
Of course, my pleasure. And thank you for being such a good host.
All right. Thank you, Isabel.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by RecTech, and this track is called Fat Tony.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back. Our in-studio guest is Justin Cherno, wine director and partner of the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Welcome, Justin.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. Thanks
Great.
For coming in.
No problem.
Justin, I want to talk to you about natural wines. I want to talk to you about small artisan producers. And, of course, I want to talk to you about the Four Horsemen. But before we get into that, I know you have a very colorful background, or at least I think so.
Okay.
And I want you to share it with my listeners because it's got a lot of wine and music to
sure.
it. So tell us a little about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And ended up living in Washington, D.C. in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s. Played music with friends there and sort of was in a couple of bands and, you know, of no renown. But, you know, it sort of became this thing that I was focused on.
Were you a musician as a kid? Like your parents
I started playing music maybe when I was like 13, 14.
Okay.
But I was really, really, really obsessively interested in music. And I was like a real record collector and things like that. And then I moved to DC and I worked in like, an interesting record store that also was a bookstore. And so I had access to all these things and I worked with people who were much more cosmopolitan than me, like that hooked me up and taught me about things and, you know, and, about music mostly and literature. And I didn't go to college. So I had access to all these books and a bunch of guys I worked with like in grad school for philosophy. And you had to learn like these little things just so you can just keep up at lunch, you know, and I was 19 and I felt like a hick that just came in from the sticks, you know.
So you were absorbing everything.
Yeah, I was absorbing anything you could because also, you know, move there, you have no friends, you connect with, you know, who you can. And then I started traveling for music and I fell in love with New York and decided to move here.
You started traveling with music.
Yeah,
so
touring the country.
With bands.
With bands.
All right, so
it's like part of what you had to do.
You formed...
I played in bands, a few bands, and one of the main ones that I was in traveled around the U.S. a bunch of times, and we were lucky enough to go to New York a lot. It was just a band called Pitch Blend. It was like a noisy punk band, and then my girlfriend and I had time. Yeah, I guess sure. Let's call it that. That's being generous, but I think that makes it sound much more sophisticated than it was, and I'll take it. So I moved up here. And needed a job, you know, didn't know what to do. But these are the days.
What year are we talking
94.
About? 94. Okay.
These were the days when you could just call a temp agency and they would give you a job. And so I ended up working at a health insurance company for 5 years, but also really, really actively playing music here. And like that was, you know, it was the time where you had a day job and you pursued your art on the side. And
for 5 years, you worked at a health company?
Yeah.
Were you playing at night? Were you
rehearse all the time, use your vacation days to go on tours, put out records, do all that kind of stuff, you know, like
you crazy? I mean, were you bored or you didn't mind?
No, I think that's a legitimate thing to do. I didn't have family money or anything like that. All my friends, we moved here and we worked. It was every musician I knew had a job and then played on the weekends or played at night or figured out a way. Also, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but you had health insurance. You had, you know, a weekly paycheck. You can buy cool guitars. You can buy all the records you wanted. You can learn all that.
You're a very logical young man.
At the time, yeah. It seemed like that all went out the window later in life. But, and so I did that for a while. Then it did start to drive me a little crazy. And then I ended up, the .com thing happened. Ended up working at a .com, doing writing, things like that. and market research kind
this
of thing.
This is New York?
Yes, yeah, so New York's okay. Probably like 98.
Right, which is when things were ramping up.
Yeah, when everything was, everybody under 30 worked at a .com essentially. Right. And then after 9/11, of course, everybody got fired from their .com jobs and everyone closed. And so I kind of floated around. I traveled in some bands, playing music, put out some records, and then bar-backed, freelance doing windows at Barney's, worked at a company called CD Now, which was an early online place, writing record descriptions on for them. Like, you know, just whatever temp job came up, whatever. I worked at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Library.
Did you ever make money with any of the bands? I mean, was it
What is money? If you mean, like, did I come back from tour and could somehow pay my rent once in a great while? Yeah.
Okay.
But no, it was never like, you know, no. It was just, it was a self-fulfilling thing. Right. It was like, you know, it was a musical not-for-profit kind of thing. Not on purpose, but that's just the way it worked out. And then by traveling and living in New York and getting into food and growing up, I grew up in a big Italian family, and being at the table was a huge part of what I did with my friends. You know, cooking Thanksgiving together, things like that was really important. I started to realize that, you know, my, like, interest, I knew a little bit about beer, but I didn't know that much about wine. You'd go to a restaurant, you wouldn't know how to order wine. You wouldn't know how to complete the whole experience. Right. You know what I mean?
Go back for a second. Mm-hmm. When you had family meals, mm-hmm. Italian, was sure. There always wine on the table?
On Sundays and things like that, there were wine. And my family that I grew up with, my mom, my brother, and my grandparents, they weren't real drinkers.
Hardcore.
But on Sunday, every Sunday, it was like the almost frozen bottle of Gallo,
right?
Or wine with peaches in it, and like kind of Chinar at the end of the meal, that kind of stuff. That was pretty normal behavior, but anyway. So I started to travel then overseas on vacation, things like that, and went to France a couple times, and that's when I really got interested in wine because I was there and I realized like I didn't know anything about this at all, and it was such a part of life. You know, and I came back and started reading a little bit, and I got some
was
books.
There a person, mm-hmm. a place, or a wine, or any combination
that came,
of those?
That came later.
That was a defining moment?
It came later.
That first trip to France?
Came later. It was just more like a vague, like kind of blurry thing.
Like some people are a 61 Latour, you know, that changed my life. Yeah,
that kind of stuff happened to me a little later in wine. But then, you know, down the road, still trying to find a job. I had a really good friend I used to live with in D.C. That worked in this new wine shop that opened called Uva in Williamsburg. And he's like, well, you know what Syrah is. You know what Cabernet is. You know Chardonnay is. Like, it's Williamsburg. Nobody's going to know more than you. Like, nobody's going to know more than that because it's a new wine store opening. It was the first wine store to not be bulletproof glassed in Williamsburg.
What year was this?
It was 01. 01. Maybe
15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Williamsburg was a much different place. Right?
Yeah, yeah. But
no bulletproof glass.
Yeah, it was Trojanowski was the other. Now it's like a really expensive hat store on North 7th in Bedford. But they were bulletproof, and this place was the first one open without glass. And
was that ever an issue?
No. It wasn't an issue, but I think the glass is pretty hard to take out once it's in. So this friend of mine, Jay, gets me a job there, and I start, you know, just start working a couple nights a week, and then I get one at a discount. I start bringing things home. The old buyer there was this guy, Shane Smith, and he was really obsessed and passionate, and it was a thing that I realized, and he was a musician as well, and immediately understood that, like, that worked for me. Like, you know, you're talking about the winemaker and you're talking about the vintage, you're talking about the wine, and that all clicked in my brain as a very similar thing. And so we started, you know, drinking together, tasting together. You'd come in at night, you'd buy a bottle during your shift, you'd listen to a record that you love, you'd drink a new wine you never had. You'd get all these young people coming in that were like, is this a wine store? But you guys look like me. I don't understand. Like, I thought wine stores weren't for, you know, artists and things like that. And it was, it was 15 years ago in Williamsburg.
The community.
It felt like it felt like just like working in a record store. It really felt like that. And so this guy, Shane, that I worked with got really into the sort of probably or very, very early wave of natural wines. And they didn't really necessarily click for me. I didn't really necessarily care about what was organic or how things were made. I was still learning, like, my geography and things like that. Yeah, I was just wide. He had already done the work. I hadn't had a background yet, you know? And So he ended up leaving to leave New York, and the owner asked me to take over. And I first thing I did was I immediately got rid of every natural wine.
Wow.
Like, I was like, these wines taste the same. I don't get this. They're all gone. And it was just such a nascent thing that nobody even noticed, really, that they were gone, except for the wine reps noticed pretty quickly that they were gone because I wasn't ordering from them anymore. And little by little, the people bringing in wines, I started to find, well, that's the one I like. That one is exciting to me. That wine is great. Okay, I really love this wine. And one by one, they all just turned out to be like low additive, like small production wines with like little no sulfur or, not yeasted, like grown organically, grown biodynamically.
No pun intended, yeah. But you organically got back into natural wines.
And but it was a very natural thing. It
you
wasn't
threw
because,
them out and then
it wasn't because,
them on your
yeah,
own.
It wasn't because I met somebody that I thought was cool that was into them or I read an article somewhere.
It tasted good.
And it tasted good. And then little by little, like I started to get into it. And then I started to develop a peer group here of people that were some of the first wave of natural wine people. And they all told me the same thing. They said, Justin, get on the plane. Go to France. Get on the plane. Go to these restaurants. Ask for these people and drink these wines. And I was like, I don't speak French. I can't do that. And they're like, dude, get on the plane. Say that you know me, whatever. And I got on the plane with a friend of mine once. And we went over and everywhere I went, they knew.
An exploratory trip.
They were excited. They were like, oh, wow, you're an American and you came here. That's crazy. Drink these wines. And, wines were really cheap and one thing led to another, like, it all clicked and it all made sense. And that was when I came back to the wine shop, when I came back to Uva, I was like, we are changing. We're changing this and these are the wines I want and, these are the wines we want to buy and this is what I want to drink and this is what I want to tell people about. And it was like an evangelical level thing where I don't want to stop anybody from drinking what they wanted to drink ever.
But you could introduce
if
them.
If I could slowly talk to people about why I love something and they wanted to hear it, because that's the kind of shop it was.
Was there distribution? Was it hard to find wines?
No, the thing that was nice about it then is that there was, this is a simpler thing, but like I liked the fact that there were only a couple people to call and they had the stuff and they were excited to sell it and it was all available. So you can get whatever
that
you wanted. That was then.
Now there's a whole
so it's a whole different thing. Yeah, but it was great. So, and you had to fight. I didn't own the store, so I've definitely, I made a lot of mistakes. I bought a lot of wine that I was thought tasted great in France and then ordered 10 cases of it and it came in. It was like totally disgusting and we didn't know what to do with it. But you learn that like over time some things settle down and they start to taste better or they change. And you learn about things like bottle variation and you learn about things like wine oxidizing and like that stuff that that you didn't pick up when you're on vacation and you're like out of your head excited.
So you were at Uva. Is it Uva?
Yeah, I was Uva for 8 years, I think.
And the epiphany of the natural wine was, about a year or two into it?
Something like that. It was a bottle of Marcel Lapierre and a bottle of Domaine Leon Barral, which is a, Lapierre. And both those wines are Kermit Lynch wines.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have my natural wine epiphany with, like, some like 1 hectare producer like plows with a goat like it makes wine in a bucket those are like at this point in time some people barely consider those naturally made wines
So 8 years there. Mm-hmm. So 8 years brings us to when? What year are we?
2013.
Okay, so what happens then?
2013, I started a friend of mine was an importer and I did some, helped him, consulted, and we did a bunch of traveling together.
Were you ready? It was like, I've done this for 8 years. Let me try this, or?
It was just, you do things in between. But in the meantime, I still traveled. And that's, I had been friends with James Murphy for a long time because he produced a record for a band of mine in 99. And so he was in Paris a lot for work. And so tickets at the time were really cheap. And he would get a really good DJ gig, like at some bar, and he'd be like, why don't you open for me, and then you'll pay you money, and then we'll have money to eat and drink together, and you make all the dinner reservations, or lunch reservations, and I want to drink wine with you. I want to learn about these
was
wines.
Was he as far along?
No.
As far as knowledge and interest at that point?
He was open. He felt my enthusiasm, and he was never a wine guy.
You order it, I'll drink it.
Well, he never was a wine guy, and then we started to drink these wines, and he tells the story better than me, but it was a thing where he was like, wait a minute, oh my God, this is awful. I think I'm a wine guy. You know, like this is the opposite of what we were supposed to be. You know, we're supposed to be Maker's Mark drinkers and, you know, beer drinkers and like, you know, that kind of thing. And like, so we were rock and roll guys, you know, at the time. Like, this is before dance punk or any of this stuff.
So that's when you befriended James Murphy.
In the 90s, yeah.
Right.
And so we were very close before that, but then we started to travel together, and then we started to try and find ourselves in Paris at the same time to drink wines, and then he started to come to Uwe a lot. And then we realized that, like, there weren't many restaurants that had these wines, and we didn't necessarily have the money to go out to eat all the time, so we started cooking and eating at each other's houses or things like that.
Don't jump ahead for me, because I want to talk about the Four Horsemen. Mm-hmm. But before that, you know, I want to talk to you because I think, you know, after what you've been talking about, you're certainly qualified to help me talk about what natural wine is.
Sure.
So let's take a few minutes and talk about that. I mean, I guess the obvious question is, what is natural wine?
I mean, it really depends.
It's fair for you to define it.
It depends who you ask.
Well, I'm asking you, and I'd be happy, you know, with your answer.
It's still, to me, this is something I do every day, something I think about every day. I'm still completely not 100% sure because I know so many people that actually make wine. I'm just a consumer. I know people that actually make wine, and they all have different descriptions, or they have different subgroups. You know,
are there any commonalities?
I mean, to me, the commonality is like minimum organic in the vineyard. At minimum organic in the vineyard. Absolutely, under no circumstances can the wine be inoculated with yeast. It has to be naturally inoculated and fermented on its own. For me, there can be no additives outside of sulfur and maybe a little copper sulfate sprayed in the vineyard.
Isabel had mentioned earlier that the amount of sulfites is so much less than regular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just like you said, just at bottling. But, you know, I know people that make wine that lots of people consider natural that I like, that I love to drink, that I will definitely in conversation say is natural wine, but see sulfur a couple times within the process.
Right.
And, you know, I know a lot of people that are cynical about natural wine that have spent a lot more time in the wine world than me that say things like, well, everybody lies. Once they shut the door to the cellar, you don't know what happens there. Once, you know, things happen, you don't know. There are wines that I love that I consider natural wines that see some temperature control in the cellar to help boost fermentation, you know, to help things jumpstart stuff.
So I was
going to
say, one of the things that comes up is very little intervention.
Yeah.
But then you talk about a guy making wine and he raises or lowers the temperature to, you know, it's not unnatural.
But then I know people. Yeah, but I also know people that just take the wine outside and get it in the sun and trying to get that to kick it up. You know, it depends. Or they have wine that's fermenting really well and they dump some of that, like a Pied de Cuve, they get that into there to kickstart the other wine. It just depends. For me, that's my base level for natural wine.
Right.
And I think that's what I consider it.
Is there a reason for confusion for defining natural wine, organic wine, biodynamic wine, sustainable? Are they all in the same basket?
I think sustainable is a complete bullshit term.
Okay.
Sustainable is just somebody that wants to do whatever they want, but also wants to sell you their wine and make you feel good about yourself and about what they do. And that's sustainable is just...
It's like buying some crappy candy bar that says natural.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a candy
bar. It doesn't matter.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like all the... When I'm trying to buy fruit juice for my son and I realize like it says natural and you flip it over and there's 30 things written on the back.
So sustainable, forget that. Yeah. What about biodynamic organic?
But biodynamic and organic, again, are separate things. Biodynamics are a philosophy written by Rudolf Steiner.
Right.
It's its whole thing. You know, there's a bunch of...
He literally defined what a biodynamic wine should be, the way to do it.
But and that's how you work. But, you know, can you be biodynamic in the vineyard and not biodynamic in the cellar? Like, you can be organic in the vineyard and then add a million non-organic things in the cellar. And you could be organic and make your wine and try to ferment your wine on its own, but share a winery in California with other people and they yeast their wine. So their yeast ends up in your wine. Like, this is I'm not a winemaker. I'm just a consumer and a buyer. And this is where I think we need to have the winemakers have a congress of some sort and figure out what all these things mean and really bring this information to us.
What am I trying to say? The best interpretation of natural wine or
organics have nothing to do with natural wine either.
Okay.
Because they're an organic additives. You can buy organic. You can buy organic additives for your wine too that change the texture and change the color and all these. This like it really comes down to no non-intervention, like staying out of the way of the wine, to me.
All right, so now I'm really confused. I want to go.
It's confusing.
And I want to take a nap because I'm dizzy. So, how do you know what a good natural wine is, or if it's really natural? You have to go to the producer.
It's about, you know, it's again, it's like as close as you can get to the producer, trusting your purveyor, trusting your store, trusting your distributor. And like that's the great thing about these wines, is that as far as the supply chain goes, it's about as close as you can get to the winemaker, which is one of the things that really attracted me to it from being from a like a DIY music background. I was used to like going to see a band and then buying a t-shirt from them at the end of the show. And when you learn about these wines and you go to a wine show and they're pouring the wine for you, you know, and they're the person who worked the vineyards and guided the wine through every part of the process, you hope for as much. It's about as transparent as you can really get.
Right.
I think.
Transparency is a big thing in the natural wine movement.
I think so.
People want to know.
Yeah.
It's the only way they understand how that's going on. So natural wines are generally made by smaller scale.
For the time being.
Right.
Yeah.
Can larger wineries scale to that, or that's not going to happen?
I mean, you know, it depends, you know. Again, I'm not a farmer, so it would be nice to see people be able to work this way in the vineyards and make, but you know, wines. But there are definitely people who have 50, 100 hectares that are...
Which is on 50, the larger end.
50 hectares is a large winery in the natural world, and there are people that do it. And I think that we'll see, because there's no definition. I mean, I'm sure there are wineries in California that are massive that say that they make natural wines.
Kotori, there's a few.
Kotori's not massive.
They say they are. They're going to be at the raw wine.
Yeah. How many hectares do they have? That's what by massive I mean scale of farmland.
Huge, I would think.
I don't think so.
Smaller?
Kotori's small. I mean, he's just 36 vintages in or something like that. He's a legend.
So he's legit.
He's totally legit.
Cool.
I don't know if you'll find anybody in California more legit than Tony Kotori.
Okay.
To be honest.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
I think he is about as real as it gets. And he was doing this when people were essentially thinking, you know, his family's been doing this much longer than anybody could even understand what it was in America.
So the commitment goes back.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything. Regardless how you feel about the wines, he's the real thing.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's always a personal thing.
But But anyway. Cool. I think that, you know, what's going to happen because there's no definition is that, like, you know, we're at this point now where every magazine you pick up is Vogue or if it's Food and Wine, or if it's, you know, some like fashion magazine, like from that's like a coffee table book or whatever, has an article on natural wine. So this is how it starts. And then before you know it, because we have no definition, the grocery store is going to be full of health conscious wines.
Are there any bodies or organizations at any level that are trying to,
you know, there's organizations for biodynamics and things like that. And there are groups, there are trade groups, there's nothing nobody anyone has to sign outside of these groups, I don't think, you know.
So somebody who's been doing it as long as you, because, you know, you have a good history, does it drive you crazy or it is what it is?
It is what it is.
You
it
sort
is
of
it
have
is.
To accept you just, it. My you job know is how to
be,
sift through
my
it.
My job is to try to be a gatekeeper and make sure that, like, what we have I consider legit. You know, but definitely, like, I can totally understand, like, the older you get, like, the more tired of it you get.
Right. I think that happens with everything
exactly.
You know. So natural wines were popular in France and Italy predominantly. Mm-hmm.
France and Japan, I think.
Japan too?
France and Japan before Italy. Italy's catching up. I think Italy...
And there
Italy,
are a lot
Italy's
of producers in,
up. Yeah, yeah.
in France,
yeah.
Loire Valley
yeah.
and in Italy. No,
France is definitely the epicenter. But as far as people drinking it, it was France and Japan.
When did... when would you say the natural movement planted its flag in the U.S.?
I want to say, like, planted its flag to start before I was, like, working
where
a wine
got
show.
Got some recognition and notice, you know, had a little traction.
I think early 2000s.
Okay.
Was probably right about time. I mean, there were definitely people running really cool lists. But as far as, like, maybe somebody getting an article in Times or something like that, that's when, you know, you got to go back to that, probably early 2000s.
When Eric Asimov or somebody
exactly.
writes about
yeah.
it, John Bond. Are natural wines readily available, or do you really have to find...
I mean, if you have a good wine shop, yeah. But then I know people in St. Louis that are just like, my God, I wish, you know, I wish we can get any of this stuff
here. So if we've
here.
Tantalized people and piqued their interest about natural wines, it's not going to be easy to sell.
There are a lot of mail order companies now.
Right, online.
You can order it online for sure.
So online.
And if you have a good wine shop and you talk to them about what you want to do, they start a conversation with their local distributors, maybe things change
in their
area.
Right. All right, let's talk about the Four Horsemen.
Okay.
Currently, you are a partner.
Mm-hmm.
You run the wine program.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Four Horsemen, when it opened, how it came about.
Sure.
You alluded to it a little.
Yeah, well, I mean, it came about as a conversation between a group of friends that thought there wasn't the place that we loved. Like, if you took all these places we loved around the world, these little, small places that had the things we liked to eat, the way we liked to eat, the way we liked to drink, and the way we felt in the place didn't necessarily exist here. We thought there was room for it, even though none of us had ever had a restaurant before. And so, you know, we sat around a table and drank a lot of wine and talked a lot about what we loved and traveled a little bit and things like that. And, you know, little by little tried to make the place that we wanted to make. And
how long did it take?
I don't know. You know, it's a good question. At least a year and a half,
okay.
maybe 2 years of, you know, from first conversations. And what Four Horsemen is to me is, first of all, we really like to think of us as a neighborhood restaurant. We can be a regular, but it's a restaurant with like a really strong wine program. We have, I think now we've changed the dining room just a little bit. We probably about 40 seats, but we have 400 references on the wine list,
wow.
Which is, you know,
it's a lot.
We're trying really hard to have things that we think are important to us.
Talk about the wine list a little. It's
sure.
predominantly
French.
French.
But we also have, like, you know,
a lot of Loire Valley,
a lot of Burgundy,
sparklers,
a lot of champagne, because we really like champagne,
right.
Which in the natural wine world is, you know, lots of people think that does not count because it's re-fermented, you know, it's fermented with extra yeast and sugar and blah blah blah. So that's
Dosage.
A whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But we love champagne, so we sell it. But we have wines that, like, we sell the wine that we love.
Well, the grower champagne movement's bigger now than ever.
For sure.
Guys probably meddle a little less or not necessarily.
I don't know. It's hard to say. Again, you know. I think, you know, champagne in itself is something that is meddled with. But it's delicious, so we sell it. We have wine from Italy. We have wine from the U.S. We have wine from Eastern Europe. We have the things that we love. And we like to represent growers that we think are important. And it's really important to us not to be everything to everyone, but it's important for us to have every customer that comes in have a great experience and not get in a fight with us. We don't want to have a philosophical blowout.
So they'll rely on you for recommendations.
They'll rely on it. We have a staff. I consider our restaurant a no-SOM zone. We have great we don't have a sommelier. We're too small. And I want everyone that comes in to have a solid experience. It sucks when you go to a restaurant and the sommelier is not there. So we have a really solid staff that we think can really get everybody through their night. And you can find people that you love that work there and come in when they work.
So tell me about the wine list. It's fairly extensive.
Yeah. We really try to represent Burgundy and things like that.
Right.
That, like, I think a lot of natural wine lists don't represent particularly well. And you know, also have some oddball stuff in there, too. People really like orange wine. And so we have a lot
Explain what orange wine is.
Skin macerated white wines. If you leave white wine on the skins for a period of time like you would a red, it develops like a texture and a color that's...
That's not like that Sutter's Zinfandel.
No.
White Zinfandel.
That's a little different. Probably similar process.
But not end product.
No, yeah. So, but you know, people love that, so we represent a lot of that kind of stuff. We try to represent just as much delicious stuff as we can. That's with the kitchen as well. You know, we like everything to be... Like
delicious is a good
adjective
for what you want to do.
I think so.
What you keep the food in consideration for the type of wines you have, or the food that's designed.
Well, we know that
we
know that our chef Nick and what he does with his team works well with the kind of wine that we like to drink. So we don't necessarily have to have meetings about, like, is this going to go with the crudo? We don't do wine pairings or anything like that. And the staff, also, you have that many wines. The staff is good enough to know how to put things out or how to drink,
right.
You know, how you can drink with it.
I noticed, you know, I follow the restaurant on social media, look at the website. From time to time, you have chefs come in.
Yeah.
and you sort of label them as the fifth horseman.
Right.
I think you just had somebody in from England.
We just had Braun in from England. Right before that, we had Le Verveillet from Paris.
Right. So how does that work? You invite someone.
Those are people that we love, you know, restaurants that we love that are, they are very influential on what we do.
Let them take over the kitchen.
We let them come in the kitchen. Or when Verveillet came, we had five of their front of house guys too. And we really try for the evening to give you the experience of their restaurant. And they trust our list enough to know that they're going to be able to represent their place.
Is it a coursed menu?
No. No, it's we want it to be a la carte like their restaurants.
So how do I find out about that? Go on the website?
It's on our website.
Is there a mailing list?
Yeah, we have a mailing list, and we'll send you info about it.
Like, have you planned the next one?
Oh, we're still working on it right now. So,
but there'll be enough
lead time. There are no tickets bought yet, so yeah.
Well, the website is?
Fourhorsemanbk.com.
.com. All right. We do a thing every week called the wine list, and I think this plays into what we've been talking about. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. I didn't prompt you on this because I want you to be spontaneous. It's pretty base, so you don't have to get nervous. But I think this will be the wine list sort of natural version, okay? Because that'll make sense. All right, so what wine are you drinking now? What's
recently?
Somebody put something in front of you, or you're stuck on something.
Right now, I've been drinking the E-Roll, which is a declassified Lirac wine from Eric Pfifferling.
Is E-Roll the type of wine?
No, that's the name of the wine, but it's a declassified. E Y R O L.
Okay.
L E, I think.
And that's from the Loire Valley.
No, it's farther in the south.
Okay.
And it's from the Southern Rhone, and I really love it, and it's been kind of my go-to. Chill it down and just kind of glug it.
All right. E-Roll. Mm-hmm. All right. I know you sort of alluded to this before that you don't do it, but do you have a favorite food and wine pairing? There's always the champagne and oyster thing.
I mean, they are muscadet and oysters and stuff like that. I really like sparkling wine and like fried food. So like something like a Pet Nat wine and like fried chicken to me is awesome. I really do like that a lot.
Tell my listeners what Pet Nat wine is.
It's just wine that's re-fermented naturally in the bottle. So
it's not a sparkling wine?
It is sparkling. So you leave wine with a little sugar in it and re-ferment.
Is it as bubbly as a sparkling wine or a little more toned down?
Well, it's sparkling, but it can be a little more toned down. Yeah, it can be a little more a little more fizzy. And the bubbles tend to dissipate faster.
Now, can Pet Nats be from anywhere?
It's just a process. It's Petit Naturel. Okay. So.
All right. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant or bar. So I'm going to ask you to answer it two ways, because I know you've been traveling to France a lot. So this puts you on the spot a little. And talk to me about New York outside of Four Horsemen.
To be honest, I have a three-year-old, and I don't go anywhere besides my own restaurant, because I can't.
You told me that.
Yeah. But, I just got back from Paris, and I still love Le Verveillet, and I love Le Chateaubriand. Those are my two – that's my home base when I'm there in Paris. And that's they have the best list and the best value for food per bottle that you can get.
All right, do you have a favorite all-time wine?
Not anymore.
Did you?
Maybe I did. I mean, for me, it was always the Beaujolais. Like, I love Guy Breton, Morgon. He makes a wine called Petit Max that I just love so, so much. That really is a really important wine to me. Unfortunately, it's not distributed. Kermit Lynch doesn't bring that cuvée in. Right. I'm not sure why. But I really like his wines a lot. I love the Burgundies from Claire Naudin. Claire, C-L-A-R-A, N-A-U-D-I-N.
N-A-U-D-I-N?
Yeah, I really like her Burgundy an awful lot. And those
wines
make me really
happy. What kind of pricing on that? Is it reasonable?
They range. Okay. But yeah, she does a really inexpensive Aligoté, and then they go all the way up.
Okay, good to know. All right, do you recall seeing a wine label that's memorable to you? Do you have a favorite wine label?
I don't, but I mean, if you talk about natural wine, they're all ridiculous cartoons.
They're in a different zone.
Exactly.
So I guess the answer is natural wine labels are cool. All right. Tell me, and you should be able to help me with this because you're in retail, you're in the restaurant. Give me your best wines for $15 or less. Recommend a white to me and recommend a red to me.
For $15 or less? I would say.
Lizzie is sitting here. She's going to a party. She's got 15 bucks. She wants to wow somebody. What's she bringing?
First thing you do is you do Muscadet.
Okay.
You do Muscadet. You do like Marc Olivier or you do Joe Landron. I'd go with Landron over that. One of his, like, he makes a wine called Amphibolite that's perfect. Tastes like lemon juice and rocks. It's like $11. It's awesome.
Great.
And then for the red, I would do like a Beaujolais Village wine. Or I would do, I'm trying to think. See, things have gotten so much more expensive since I worked retail.
Right.
But I would do like, yeah, I just try to find I would talk to somebody where they worked and try to find like the least interventionist Beaujolais Village that you can get.
So there's Beaujolais Cru and Beaujolais Village.
Village is just the basic gimme. Yeah. Bottom of the hill kind of stuff. Yeah, by the village. Yeah.
Got it. All right. Two good choices. Mm-hmm. All right. Justin, we do a weekly wine sip here. We taste a bottle of wine.
Okay.
I want you to stay here and taste with us. All
okay.
right. So we're going to pour it out. Our friend Lizzie Noonan is going to help us pour out four glasses of wine.
Okay.
All right. And what we're drinking is, this is a 2014 Michel Gassier Costières de Nîmes Nostre Pays. This is an organic wine. It's not a natural wine because I couldn't find a natural wine.
To the wrong store.
I did. It's from the southern region of the Rhone, the southernmost part of the Rhone region in France. It's a white blend of Grenache Blanc, Roussanne, Viognier, Claret, and Bourbon Blanc. Those are all, you know, white blending wines. Mm-hmm. This wine retails for about $16 to $20,
cool.
and it's available at, you know, better mm-hmm. wine stores. Yeah. So let's give it a sniff, a sip. What are you getting on the nose?
It tastes like it's from somewhere it smells like it's from somewhere very warm.
Okay.
And it definitely smells like it's Roussanne.
Southern
yeah.
Rhone?
Yeah, it smells like it's Roussanne, Marsanne kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't really pick up the Viognier in the nose. Viognier always kind of smells like my grandma's perfume, like kind of like too much perfume
Florally.
On the way to church. Yeah.
All right, what about the mouthfeel? I feel a little acidity. Medium?
Yeah, I feel a little acidity. Feels like maybe not naturally occurring acidity.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't know the wine at all. I'm not sure. That's
okay.
just like judgmental stuff.
It's
it's definitely brighter and fresher than I would expect from the way it smelled.
Right.
And if it was cold, it would be if it was a little colder, maybe it would be a little easier. But
tell me what you pick up on the palate.
I don't know. To me, it tastes like ripe yellow fruit. Reminds me of like when you're a kid, like Juicy Fruit gum. Like it tastes like tropical, little like mangoes, kind of cantaloupe,
sort of
that kind
like
of thing.
You said the tropical, more exotic fruits and all of that. All right. Would you pair this with anything? I mean, does it make sense?
I mean, yeah, I see people eating something like this, like a pork chop, something like that.
It could hold up to a pork chop. All right, so. You don't love this wine.
It's not my thing. I don't think it's poorly made or anything like that. It's just not my thing.
Okay.
I like crackingly dry, like tear the enamel off your teeth white wines.
It's a little sweet. All right. So that was the Michel Gassier, the 2014 Costières de Nîmes Nostre Pays from the southern Rhone region of France. All right. Finally, we spoke to Isabelle Legeron earlier. She is launching the Raw Wine Fair in Brooklyn. It's a two-day celebration of some of the best wine talent in the world and features over 100 growers. Raw Wine is one of the most exciting collections of fine, natural, and biodynamic wine artisans ever to come to Brooklyn. That's on November 6th and 7th. It's from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's at an exhibition space at 99 Scott Avenue in Brooklyn. You can go to rawwine.com for more info. There's going to be wine people there pouring wine. There's going to be talks and seminars. Justin's actually going to be involved in one of them.
Yeah, with a bunch of really outstanding local, not necessarily sommeliers, but people that have locally written like really solid natural wines.
Right.
And I'm talking about what it's like to serve these wines.
So if you want to get up to speed on natural wines, the Raw Wine Fair, November 6th and 7th, is the place to be. If you have a wine happening or event, hit me up at Sam at the Grape Nation. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. We'll also eventually post the wine list and the wine sip selections and all of that. I'll get to that at some point. And finally, thank you to our guest, Isabelle Legeron from Raw Wine, and our in-studio guest, Justin Chernow from the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Thanks to our engineer, Pierre, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. Go to heritageradionetwork.org for more info.
Theme music for this program is brought to you by The Grautet. That's Grautet.
thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.